How much to the Buddha? How much to the Dharma? How much to the Sangha? So I think 2 weeks ago, I asked people to submit questions that they would like to hear addressed in a Dharma talk setting. And several of them had to do with just how do I maintain a strong practice away from the Zen Center? And I think whether you're brand new to this or you've been practicing for many years, that's an ongoing, I don't know, struggle. Sometimes it feels like a struggle, but it's an ongoing question. So I figured it would be relevant to everybody. So first of all, I wanted to start with the question of what do we mean by practice? So it's kind of funny, we get, you know, within these particular circles, we end up having this vocabulary and language, and, you know, there's not too many non-Buddhists you could talk to who could say, you know, how's your practice been lately? Be like, what? But for us, oh, okay. So obviously this is an English word, but I don't really know too much about the, you know, Japanese or the Chinese or the Indian terms for this or whether they really had a similar word, but what's kind of cool is that the English word has three different meanings that all apply. So one, practice is the actual application or use of an idea, belief, or method, as opposed to theories. So it's the actual application of our, you know, our aspiration or what we're learning. Also, two, the customary, habitual, or expected procedure or way of doing something. So then it's, you know, I have a practice of, or, you know, there's an established way to do something. And then three, repeated exercise in or performance of an activity or skill so as to acquire or maintain proficiency in it. So there's that kind of aspect of practice as well, that we are hoping to, you know, we kind of try to avoid the word improve, but, you know, to grow, learn. So how do we do that? And I am going to, I have 15 copies of probably enough for most people. Many of you are familiar with this already, but these are my 9 fields of Zen practice. So this is the, and describing all these different aspects of our practice. And it's not meant to be overwhelming in the sense that there's 9 areas and you better be covering all of them and, you know, like, now you've got to take on this huge monumental task. I guess I see my purpose in describing them. Oh, I guess I need one as well. Save one for me. my purpose in describing them was really just to show how broad the sense of practice can be, how many different areas of our life, how many different forms it can take. Because sometimes when I ask people about their practice, they talk to me about maybe 3 things. You know, how often am I attending the Zen Center? You know, how often am I sitting and how much? And am I like reading or studying anything? So that's kind of, you know, many times that's just the first place people's minds go. But obviously, it's much bigger than that. So just very briefly, we'll go over these. And if you find this helpful at all and you haven't seen this before, you're welcome to take this home. So obviously, there is Zazen. That is our central, our central practice. Then there's Dharma study. And really, this is exposing ourselves to the teachings. And we don't need to have memorize everything or learn everything, or I don't know. Sometimes I still mean to come up with some kind of suggested reading list or something like that. I do think it's good to get basics in the foundational teachings, which I have, you know, a series of things on my podcast that, you know, identify that, and we're also covering that on Tuesdays. So there's some basics that it's good to be familiar with and know, but I found most time it works simply to kind of follow your nose, to just kind of let it unfold organically, that you read this thing and it refers to that thing and that's intriguing, so you go check out that thing, and then, you know, in the reading group they happen to be reading that thing, so I guess we'll read that, and then it just kind of leads, and there's a beautiful sense in which almost all Dharma teachings kind of cover the same thing. So there's a certain way in which you could just study Dogen, or you could just study, you know, one particular segment and end up reaching everything that you needed to. So in that sense, you don't have to worry too much about, getting it all, or are you reading the right things or whatever, but just as long as there's some sense that you're learning and exposing yourself to the teachings. Because they do frame our practice, and they frame the, you know, what it is that we are trying to awaken to. And then the third area I call cultivating insight. This one's a little harder to get wrap your mind around, perhaps. Are you doing it? Are you not doing it? I don't know. For me, you know, this overlaps with Zazen. This overlaps with Dharma study. This overlaps with taking time to go to meditation retreats. I guess it's more of a holding an intention to really understand. It's holding an intention to really see and experience what the teachings are pointing to for ourselves. Because you can kind of imagine maybe just kind of sitting Zazen, kind of like a sack of potatoes, and reading the Dharma stuff and just, I don't know, letting it flow in one ear and out the other without really trying to engage it and make it real for yourself. Then we have precepts, which we study every year, and which I feel like, because the precepts are about relationship, this is how our practice manifests throughout the day. This is like, once you get up off the cushion, then it's pretty much precept work. It's watching how they function and how our temptations to break precepts arise, and how that reflects back on our self-attachment and all those kinds of things. Then there's opening the heart, which we do through our bodhisattva vow, through metta practice, practicing the Brahmaviharas and paramitas. And it's sometimes it might be an easy thing to miss in terms of, you know, if you're just looking at classic Zen practice and training, it might look kind of just austere or self-focused. But Chosen says, when we take the bodhisattva vow, we vow to free all beings. He said, we vow to free all beings from ourselves. Like, that's what our self-work. Yeah, it's relieving our own suffering, but it's also so that we can actually be, you know, of more benefit to other people and less of a pain to other people. So definitely, if we do all the other practices, but still our heart is closed, you know, we're really missing an essential piece. Another part that's a little bit easy to miss, which is just why I laid it out there, is connecting with the ineffable. Having some sense of greater meaning or purpose or foundation to it all, that we don't reify the way that theistic traditions do, but nonetheless, if that's missing, then there's something missing from our practice as well. If it doesn't give us a sense of, I don't know, that there's something beyond just the everyday mundane crap that we have to deal with, that there's something more noble. Then there is Nyoho. I'm using that term to describe this. It's not traditionally used so much that way, but I'm using it because it means in accord with the Dharma in very mundane and practical ways. So it traditionally refers to monastic, like dress and and habits of eating and the, how they conduct themselves, but in daily, like how they brush their teeth and how they, you know. So that's Nyoho. So if we expand that beyond the monastic setting, then it's really how we do anything. How do we treat objects? How do we open doors? How do we, you know, how do we smile at people when we walk past? How, you know, everything, you know, it's that message that everything matters. How we do anything is how we do everything, you know, that kind of thing. Then there's also karma work. So, you know, we did that verse, all my past and harmful karma, born from beginningless greed, hate, and delusion, through body, speech, and mind, I now fully avow. So, you know, just saying that verse isn't enough. We have to continue to work on ourselves. And this obviously overlaps in some senses with precepts, because precepts will often point us toward our attachments and stuff. But it goes, our karma gets a lot, it's a lot more profound and subtle and complicated than that. Sometimes it's, you know, past trauma or experiences or things that we need to let go of or heal from. It's, you know, certain things that might be strengths, but they come along with shadows and weaknesses that we need to acknowledge, and we need to learn how to be more skillful in our actions with interactions with other people. You know, my karma, if you will, is you know, and we don't really speculate where did this come from. It doesn't really matter where it came from or how we ended up this way. This is here we are. So mine, for instance, is like I really like to get stuff done. I'm full of ideas and full of energy, and I constantly want to improve things. See issue, like, you know, what we could do. We, you know, that's just, and that's a very useful energy. But that also means then I will tend to not give people the proper time and attention, because they're just getting in the way of my project, which I'm doing for them. But, you know, like, so I would probably be one of those parents that would just, you know, be working all the time and be like, well, I put a roof over your head and I fed you and like got you into good school. Like, what are you complaining about? And like, yeah, but you never just like sat down and watched TV with me. So, anyway, you know, recognizing that karma, getting to know ourselves and our blocks and our strengths and our weaknesses and facing them and learning to be more skillful with them. And then bodhisattva activity. We do take that vow. So trying to be a benefit in the world. So, all right, what is Zen practice? Well, I like to call them fields, because there's many different aspects of practice that then you can fit into these different places. So I know I've talked about the 9 fields before, but any thoughts or questions before I move on? Yeah?
In cultivating insight, you said this means wrestling with the teachings and passionate investigation in our meditation. Mm-hmm. Our meditation was about not thinking.
I mean, that's a whole Dharma talk in and of itself. Okay. I think it's a really good question, and it's kind of either or. So we did the Hongzhi's silent illumination. We did the, you know, and the way that he describes it is like our zazen includes both these points. It includes the silence and stillness, and it includes illumination. But, like, you know, in order to get that silence, we're just letting go, right? We're not trying to figure anything out. Don't have an agenda. So where does investigation come in? Where does insight come in? And it's like, I don't know. For me, it's subtle. It's like, at one point he says in Hongzhi says in his writing, bright clarity appears before you. So what it feels like to me is that I remain very still, But sometimes something comes to the fore. And it might come to the fore in part because I am holding this question. I am saying, you know, where is my grief coming from? Or I don't know, or, you know, who am I really, or something. So it's not so much that I am deliberately, you know, examining that during Zazen, but if I'm holding it in my heart and mind and body, then when I am sitting there very still, that question is there. It's just there. It's just part of me. And then it feels like insight can happen. We don't make it happen. So it's kind of an openness to it and a stillness. And I don't know, maybe other people can speak to this as well, but you know, when I manage to get really still, which usually isn't in my daily Zazen, but you know, maybe during a retreat or something, and I get very still, something will just become clear. Something will just be like, oh, look what I'm trying to make happen, or oh, look, you know, why I'm having this issue, or I don't know. Anybody else want to speak to that kind of the experience of illumination and insight, even though we're not, that we're still in that space of Zazen?
Well, this might throw a wrench into things. I would say some of my most insightful moments have not been during Zazen, but have been during mindfulness. And it's pretty amazing. I don't know where that comes from. But in an instant, problem solved or answer given. That's because, and it's usually me. But it's pretty amazing.
Yeah. And I think that's a good point. I can't remember how I describe it, but I think that holding questions and having that spirit of investigation is something that is definitely not limited to the meditation cushion at all. I think it's necessary to create that space for that silence and stillness in order for the whole process to be working properly.
When there's nothing hanging off of the inquiry, you can be that much more playful with it. You do things show up.
Any answer to the question appears that you're not necessarily engaged in quiet activity at that point, but you've cleared enough space so that it's able to work, and then suddenly it blossoms at a point when you're not, you know, you're not looking at it, but it's like you're doing something else, and it's like, oh, that's what it's going on.
And it's weird that there does need to be just the effort that's required is not a figuring out effort, but Kyogen, we used to describe it as, if there's a door and you want to know what is on the other side of that door, like, and we've found, this is where the metaphor breaks down, but you know, you can't break it down. So all you can do is just kind of, he said, maybe you even have, just keep your hand on the door. Maybe you even just keep your eye on the door. So there's a kind of openness and questioning. You're not demanding an answer, but you're, because there'd be a difference too if it's just like, well, I don't know what's on the other side of that door, but then you could just go about your business and forget about it. Then it's unlikely that it's that you're going to notice when it opens, or yeah.
It seems like in some way it kind of works like yeast.
And
I think that analogy works well for me, because my preference, and one of the things I really love about the nine fields, is their structure. I really want that, and I want to then systematically go through and deal with it, but that is impossible because the ideas bump into each other, or they aren't compatible. You can't both think nothing and have inside at the same time. I don't know. I love this, but I probably
will misuse that. Well, and it is like you just kind of throw all these ingredients in the pot and cook and something happens. So I do feel like, you know, all of these ingredients to a certain extent are contribute something, but the process is very organic. And
I like that analogy too. I love it in soups.
I like what you said earlier about following your nose. There's something to simply being honest to the question. The question is here. It's a point of confusion. It's not going anywhere. Let it be right there.
Yeah.
And it kind of draws the answer to itself.
Huh. Like that.
I think when we're open to this kind of synchronicity and just get out of our own way.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good.
So in a way, that ties in with, another way of looking at practice. So I feel like all of these are, you know, this describes different elements of practice. But there's also a way that you could throw away all of this stuff, not that I suggested, but, and that practice is really how we live moment to moment. And I like to think of it as living deliberately. Every moment, as you walk out of here, as you get into your car, as you engage the people in the rest of your day, as you go about your work, as you, every single thing, how are you going to meet that, whatever is happening? So deliberately, I looked up deliberately, I love words. It's consciously and intentionally, on purpose, or in a careful and unhurried way. I like both of those. So, you know, every moment of every day, how are we going to pay attention, think, speak, act, respond in such a way that will lead to greater wisdom and compassion, as opposed to just but through self-centeredness and habit energy. If we don't live deliberately, then much of the time we're just going to be drawn by that. And we're making a choice. Whenever I notice, I'm going to live deliberately.
What did you say the definition of deliberate?
Consciously and intentionally, on purpose.
Well, for some reason, my mind just went to deliberate. So it's like things are not at chaos. They are. According to the rules or the guidelines.
Because, I mean, I think what I like about approaching practice this way is because, I mean, this is what we're doing most of the time, is just living. You know, we can't keep 9 fields of ideas all the time. You know, most of the time we're just living our lives. And this is something that we can do at absolutely any time. Where am I? What's going on? What choices do I have in front of me? How can I engage this so it fits with my aspirations, whatever those are? And we can't, you know, unlike in some religions, our aspirations are not so simple. We can't just say, well, we want to go to heaven. you know, ours are a little more elusive, but for each of us, it means we might phrase it a little differently. Living as fully as possible, appreciating each moment of our life, living freely instead of being caught by karma and habits, or, you know, waking up to reality, or, you know, however that is phrased, as that's what you really want to make the rest of your life. So then practice is just living deliberately in order to align with that aspiration whenever you can. So really, really strong practice is doing this every single moment. I mean, I don't know that it's humanly possible to do it every single, but but it's possible to do it more often. It's always possible to do it more often. So really the externals of our practice may look different for each person, but you know, somebody who's living in that really, really deliberate way, it's just very, very strong practice. And it's also something that we get to taste a little bit of when we're at a meditation retreat, because it's all kind of set up to encourage us to do that, encourage us to live that way. To make we have this elaborate meal ceremony. So we're paying, ideally we kind of have to pay attention to everything that we do while we eat, which ordinarily we don't, right? Ordinarily we're not even just talking to somebody and shoveling it in. So trying to pay attention. So that was, I haven't even gotten to the point of keeping practice alive away from Sangha, maintaining a strong practice away from the Zen Center. I guess I thought of three things. And one is, I've already been talking about, is seeing practice as permeating your life. That as opposed to thinking of it, I mean, there are those elements like Zazen and participating with Sangha, whatever, that are good to have. But rather than thinking of that as like, well, you know, so I practice on Tuesdays and I practice for a half an hour in the morning and, and that's where I practice. Trying to recognize in what way everything else you do is practice. So that helps, I don't know, I think that offsets that sense of inadequacy that our lives are busy and I don't do enough Dharma reading and, you know, whatever. But it's like, but if you think of precept practice and yoho practice and the spirit of inquiry and, like, you know, you can be practicing all the time. That was what I was so thrilled when I got into Zen. I was like, I never have to let this go. This can be with me all the time. And sometimes I forget, but as soon as I remember, there it is. Any thoughts about that?
I was thinking that one way I think of practice, I think much comes from taking piano. Mm. And so the practice is like a rehearsal for when I play for my teacher during the week or something like that. And so in some way, that seems how it works for me in the way that you're talking about, you know, away from the Zendo or away from, is that like the retreat or the session is really concentrated. But it's also like a rehearsal, so if some of those pieces are refreshed in my life, and then it's easier for them to come up again day to day in daily activities. And so sometimes it's like this concentrated way of being that then allows it to seep into in less deliberate ways. It just starts to become new habits and forms.
Yeah.
Maybe habits of thinking and habits.
Which brings me to the second way. So the second way to maintain a strong practice away from the Zen Center is, unfortunately, just creating new habits. And there's kind of no shortcut for that. I think of like, Zazen is like exercise and other forms of practice as well, but especially Zazen, which is our core practice that we're really trying. That's usually what people are talking about when say away from the Sangha, how do I make myself sit? You know? So I guess it is just totally, you know, you just gotta start at some point, you know, and I have totally had this experience with exercise. I have gone for years without exercising. And then, you know, you just at some point there's a day when you have to go do it. And it's kind of a bummer, and it takes a lot of energy to make yourself do it, but you just have to start. But then, you know, once you start, like most habits, then it becomes easier and kind of self-fulfilling because it's actually enjoyable or it's actually beneficial. So, you know, just in terms of Zazen, because one of the questions that got submitted was, how much should I sit? you know. And I think, you know, it being just like exercise is a great example. There's no minimum amount. I mean, if you're going to go for a 15-minute walk once a week, that is better than nothing. That is definitely better than nothing. You know, I think, just to throw a number out there, I think a kind of reasonable but good maintenance amount in a lay life is 30 minutes a day, 5 days a week. So that can be kind of a aspiration to go toward, but it's also like exercise in the sense that if you sat 30 minutes a day, 7 days a week, or if you sat an hour a day, or, you know, that you would see some benefits from doing more. Of course, I don't know that I have to say this to anybody in here, but it's also like exercise, and like, you don't just go run a marathon without working up to it and having some support. So sometimes people really will, usually younger folks, will just get into this and they will just start sitting 3 hours a day on their own. And I would say that's like, I don't think you should. I mean, if you're going to do that, you know, have contact with a sangha and a teacher. Have, you know, just like you wouldn't do that without a physical trainer, you know, or you might hurt yourself. Just, you know, so, but generally speaking, you know, 30 minutes a day, an hour a day, maybe even 2 hours a day, probably not going to be any harm in that. Or, you know, sometimes it is just more like, you know, you're not going to be able to do it every day. Your life is really busy, but you can do it on Wednesdays and Fridays. You know, hey, whatever works. And there's no, also in terms of timing, I had a practice for a while when my life was very busy and I didn't have my online meditation in the morning, where there were some days when I did not sit, and I just made a vow to, I think some of us like went into it together, like every day, sitting every day vow. And so sometimes it was my husband had gone to bed already, I've brushed my teeth, put the toilet seat down, and I sat there for 5 minutes. I put my timer on and I sat Zazen for 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. And it was valuable. I mean, even if I hadn't sat all day, just to, you know, for 5 minutes to just take that space and kind of come home to myself and whatever, even that was valuable. So sometimes it's like, if we have too much of an idea of I have to sit 20 minutes or I have to sit 30 minutes, or then we don't do it. So it's kind of like, well, what can you do? What can you actually do? And then, yeah, any thoughts on that aspect?
I wanted to sit more, and so when we did our vows for the through April 19th, I you know, made a vow about that. And I had this experience this last week that in order to meet my goal of 4 to 5 times a week, I had to go sit, and it was the most amazing experience I had when I realized I was only going to sit for 5 minutes, but I got to count it because I did sit. So it got to be one of the 4 or 5 minute week, and that was like it must be leftover from going to confession, and, you know, or something. That you, how did that count? And that, well, it did. It's that. It wasn't long enough, but I did it.
Yeah.
So I gave it a count and my little chart, and I thought it was like really hard for me to accept that I didn't do it completely. Mm. But I did do it, so it counted.
Yeah.
It was really, it's like those things happen in your head when you're trying to sort this through.
Right.
I cheated.
And yet, you know, I think making a space for it more often, even if it is really short, is perhaps more impactful than just doing it once a week or something like that. Because it feels to me like a it kind of changes the whole character of the day. It's kind of like a grounding or a pivot point or something for the whole day. Yeah. And really, you know, commitments, vows, you know, just like all other habits, whatever works. Like I've said before, I will not exercise unless I'm signed up for a class at a gym. I won't. I just won't. You know, it'd be like, you can walk around the block, but I won't. I just won't. But somehow, if I sign up for a class, that's no problem. So I don't know. You know, it's like whatever, you know, do it in the morning, do it in the evening, do it, you know, for 20 minutes before somebody gets home. You know, make a pact with a buddy, do your commitments, or find some way to work it into your life as a commitment like I do, where I host online meditation from 7:30 to 8:30 in the morning, Wednesday through Saturday. So it's at my home. You know, just I get up at 7, I have a cup of coffee, I'm out there. So it's minor, you know, not very disruptive. So I end up sitting for a whole, you know, 50 minutes, and then we do chanting. And I have to be there. So it's like now I sit 6 days a week, no problem. It's not a struggle at all because I have to show up and turn the computer on and be there to ring the bells for people. So, I mean, those kind of making commitments to those kinds of things is a really big deal. But hey, I've got a video conference room that you can use. If you want to sit at a different time, or you know, once a week or something, and you want to say I'm gonna host online meditation during that time, and then you have to show up, and maybe one or two other people are going to show up with you, but then you will have made it a part of your life. And I think it's probably related that, you know, people sign up to open and close here or to do various jobs. And sometimes I look around the room and I'm like, okay, half the people here just had jobs, you know, and they had to come. But that's, hey, that's part of it. You know, you've signed up for it. Just sign up for it and you know, like, all right, it's going to strengthen my practice because I don't have a choice. Bob, you were going to say something.
Oh, I was just going to, one of the educational modalities is lecture, at the university. And we learned that the way students learn is in a 20, 25-minute cycle. Mm. So you present something, you do 25 minutes of lecture, then you have jokes, you get off the topic. It allows the student to consolidate that information. Huh. And I found a very interesting resonance with the way we do our services here, where we have 20 minutes or so, Kinhin, another 20 minutes. And I contrasted that with the notion of having 2 hours of meditation. You know, it's like, I don't think that's a good idea. I think you're right. You need a teacher to, you know, help.
Well, and I mean, hopefully you'd break that up. But yeah, I think you're right. And I notice sometimes when I sit, sometimes I have problems with drowsiness. And sometimes after Kinhin, then I won't. What changed? I don't know. I'm still just as tired, right? Something will shift in that little transition time. So, yeah, I just encourage people to think outside the box. One of the things that's valuable for meditation is knowing that you won't be disturbed. That's one of the big things. So, depending on your living situation, I lived in a little one-bedroom apartment with a partner at one point, and I would commandeer the bathroom for, you know, you need to use the bathroom? All right, I'm in there for the next half an hour, and I would meditate in the bathroom. creating a meditation space or an altar. I've heard of people sitting behind the wheel of their car at lunch or in their office at work during lunch break, you know, just grabbing those times. And we just do our best. And sometimes a particular aspiration or practice doesn't fit into our life at the moment. That we, I guess, we should never let our practice make us miserable. Like, that kind of defeats the whole purpose. So if we're feeling like kind of inadequate or guilty or whatever, I mean, that's just doesn't help. So, like, I remember, you know, and for one of the things I should have said at the beginning is like this whole keep maintaining a strong practice at home. Buddhists had admitted from day one that that is hard. That is why there is monastic life. That is why the Buddha said, here, you know, leave home and follow these regulations and have this structure and, you know, it'll be decided for you how your day goes and you'll concentrate on this stuff and you won't have to deal with all this stuff. It's hard. It's hard to keep the thread going in the middle of things. But I never lived for a long period of time in a monastery, but I was at the Dharma Rain Zen Center and we had a practice schedule. And when I was a junior monk, I was obligated pretty much from dawn till dusk in one way or another, either I was sitting or working or participating in the meals or whatever. And then they don't do it so much now, but during the summertime, really go on a break. Like there wouldn't be so much of the daily routine or the daily schedule of morning meditation or whatever. And I felt completely abandoned. I just felt like I'm not, because I couldn't keep this up by myself. I would just stay up too late and sleep too late. And I would just, my practice would just fall apart. And I remember begging my Dharma brother to like, can we make some kind of pact that, you know, we'll show up in the Zendo at the same time or whatever. And I remember being really, really sad and frustrated because he's somebody who has amazing self-discipline. He did not need me. he got up at the crack of dawn and he did Qigong and then he did, you know, sat and he didn't need me at all. So, you know, there are some people that can do this. Most of us can. It is hard to maintain this kind of structure on our own. But and one more thought before we wrap up is about making space for contemplation and reflection in your life. Now, maybe other people don't really relate to this. Maybe it's, you know, I focus on it because I am somebody who likes to get stuff done. But I think it's pretty common in our society not to make a priority of making space for doing nothing. I mean, space for just contemplation, fallow time, you know, relaxing with a Dharma book, whatever, that, you know, we got a lot of stuff to do and it's hard to fit that in. And so it kind of slips down our list of priorities. So I think just having a certain kind of consciousness about the tendency to do that and reminding ourselves of the value of just carving out this space in our life for putting everything aside, setting aside trying to figure anything out, fix ourselves, do anything. To me, it feels like a really sacred thing to do. I mean, I still resist it and I still sit there and start to figure stuff out, but I you know, what I'm trying to do personally is, all right, you know, the beginning of my 50 minutes in the morning, just kind of set a little intention for myself. All right, for this hour of time, I'm going to set aside all of my projects, all of the things that I'm working on. You know, I don't have to do them this hour. I'll be working on them for the remainder of my waking hours. So can I just, you know, let them go here? So whenever I notice that I've picked up some concern like that, then there's just letting it go. So I guess that's it. Any thoughts or questions?
I like that the word space is used here at the end, because I think having the choice of a physical space in our house, I know I would say to parents, your child deserves to know where they can sit and do some homework. Mm. I mean, just that kind of cutting that out in your physical space. And so that helps make our habits can serve us if we allow them. And so that kind of helps me, or I, even at least if I'm just facing my little Buddha statue or something, I know it's there, it's waiting for me, kind of thing. And I see kind of stepping into the doorway of allowing that practice to tap me on the shoulder and say, yeah, I'm here for you, I'm glad you are.
All right. Well, thank you all. I'll first. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita.